So first, thanks to Javi for the invitation to speak here today. Thank you very much. This is a shortened version of a paper that I've written with Robin Bloom, who probably many of you know, who's come to many roundtables in the past. References to we throughout the paper are not just me being pretentious, they refer to us. It's customary at my university now to give trigger warnings when there's content that might be worrisome. There's some ethics in here, which I know is like explicitly forbidden in the call for papers. But I think some of the most interesting questions in philosophy of medicine occur at the intersection of epistemology and ethics, and so I sort of unabashedly go there every time. So I'm going to do that again. So in this paper, we begin by outlining a key moment in the history of the research practice distinction in medicine, and in doing so, draw attention to the shaky conceptual foundations of that distinction. We track subsequent problems arising from the use of this distinction through contemporary literature on boundary cases, and then identify some additional, less widely appreciated epistemic assumptions that track the distinction. We argue that these epistemic assumptions need to be explicitly tackled and rejected in the design of any system that aims to integrate research and practice. In the final sections of the paper, we survey two different models of integrative systems that have been proposed and weigh their success at addressing the epistemic concerns identified. So we argue that the more radical model of integration does better in this respect. This is familiar to everybody. Public awareness of a series of scandals in medical research grew in the late 1960s and early 1970s thanks to investigative journalists and whistleblowers within the medical research community. The need for national regulation was especially acute in the United States, where many of the most widely publicized cases of abuse of research subjects had taken place. So in 1974, the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research was established by the United States Congress to develop a system that would prevent future abuses. Since it was a series of abuses of human subjects that led to the creation of this commission, it's not surprising that the members believed their responsibility to be to the protection of research subjects. In order for the commission to stick to this mandate, however, it needed to be able to distinguish between the activities that counted as research and those that were routine clinical practice. After considerable debate, they decided to adopt a strict segregation model, which rested on a sharp distinction between research and practice in medicine. So the reasoning for this, explored in some detail in an excellent paper by Beecham and Sagkai, was primarily political. Specifically, members of the commission opted for a definition of research that would avoid confrontation with practicing clinicians, as you do. So as one member put it, there was a jurisdictional problem that if the commission was allowed to go to the protection of human subjects in all of medicine and medical practice, then we would have been in the medical practice area, and that would have raised such a fuss in Congress and in organized medicine that this commission never would have been born. So the strict research practice distinction was driven by the practical desire to avoid encroaching on the autonomy of physicians in clinical practice rather than by any deeper argument at the time. So here's how they drew that distinction. For the most part, the term practice refers to interventions that are designed solely to enhance the well-being of an individual patient or client and that have a reasonable expectation of success. The purpose of medical or behavioral practice is to provide diagnosis, preventative treatment, or therapy to particular individuals. By contrast, the term research designates an activity designed to test an hypothesis, permit conclusions to be drawn, and thereby to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. So in short, whereas clinical practice aims solely to benefit the individual patient, research aims to contribute to general knowledge. The policy issue regarding which activities should undergo prospective ethics review was settled by declaring that any activity that included as one of its aims the production of generalizable knowledge should be subject to review. And we start to see a little bit of what do we do happening there already. Since the Belmont Report, the research practice distinction has taken on a life of its own. It's now central to both philosophical work in research ethics and research oversight policies throughout the world. We find an almost identical definition in many international codes of ethics. You find actually the language replicating almost exactly. So here from SIOMS, which is an international set of an international ethics code, we see that same language develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. So that's how we think of what research is. Okay, so today, The idea that we ought to rethink this distinction and even deliberately pursue greater integration between research and practice is growing in popularity. This is partly because of the proliferation of boundary cases, that is, of activities that appear to blur the line between research and practice and the desirability of those activities. Some of these boundary cases have arisen because of changes in research methods that bring research protocols closer to clinical practice. An example here is the increasing use of pragmatic trials, which may enroll patients with comorbid conditions or those who are taking additional medications. They may also allow for variations in dosage of the treatment being studied in the trial, and some even allow research participants to choose among the treatment options available in the trial. So more traditional explanatory trials, the ones we would think of when we think of RCTs by contrast, tend to exclude such patients and maintain strict treatment protocols with the aim of minimizing variability within the treatment and control groups, and therefore obtaining clean results or precise estimates of the outcome difference between the study groups. So pragmatic trials are also often examples of comparative effectiveness research, in that they test a treatment of interest against other current therapies rather than placebo. Because these trials replicate many of the conditions of normal clinical practice, it's becoming harder for researchers and clinicians to see why different ethical rules ought to apply in these two domains. So research is starting to look more like practice. Coming from the other side of the traditional boundary, there are activities associated with clinical practice that are increasingly also used for research purposes. So for instance, as electronic patient records become more common, they are used to provide important data about outcomes in large groups of patients. In addition, quality improvement studies were initially, when they were used, restricted to internal audits of local programs or services, but they now provide information that is used outside of those local contexts. Another example of this type of boundary case is practice-based research networks, which include, for instance, primary care physicians working in different clinics and hospitals, tracking patient outcomes in their respective practices along agreed-upon outcome measures. These networks recognize the importance of the knowledge gained in clinical practice and aim to contribute to a general knowledge base. So because research and treatment have been differentiated on the basis of their goals, boundary cases like these, which aim both to treat patients and to provide generalizable knowledge, are seen as a challenge to the traditional research practice distinction. It is important to note, however, that there have always been studies that challenge the boundary. For instance, phase one oncology studies, particularly with pediatric patients, typically deliver standard care in the context of clinical research. Similarly, the development of new surgical techniques, the use of off-label prescriptions, and the compassionate use of investigational drugs are not clearly either research or standard care as characterized. So we argue that the separation of research and clinical practice, as initially described in the Belmont report, both accepts and reinforces two problematic epistemic assumptions, and we believe it's vital that proposed integrative accounts examine and explicitly reject these assumptions if they are to achieve their own goals. So first, we're struggling with the language here. So if you have better terms for any of these things, let me know. First, acceptance of the research practice distinction promotes the idea that the explanatory randomized controlled trial, or RCT, is both the paradigm and the pinnacle of clinical research studies. This is because research is defined as systematic inquiry that aims at generalizable knowledge, and the RCT is taken to promise the most systematic methods and therefore to provide the most generalizable results. Or so it is claimed. For example, the push to conduct RCTs instead of non-randomized or observational studies comes from the idea that only RCTs are able to determine whether there's a causal relationship between treatment and response, because only RCTs are able to balance potential confounding factors between the treatment and control groups. This means that RCTs identify the real effect of treatment rather than the apparent effect that is actually the result of other factors, such as the specific population being studied. Knowledge of this real effect means supposedly that the results of RCTs can be generalized to other treatment contexts in ways that other research results cannot. There is, of course, a vast literature on the problems with this position, which I think a number of people in this room have contributed to. It's beyond the scope of this paper to review all of these concerns, but for the purposes purposes of this paper, the main issue is that the results of RCTs are actually not all that generalizable. And I'm skipping over in the paper a review of the literature on this point, given that this is an expert audience. I thought that would be a place I could actually do a little cutting. So as an illustration of the extent to which researchers have pursued these clean, explanatory RCTs, actually I spoke on this, I think, at the last roundtable. A recent study in JAMA Internal Medicine from April 2013 found that, quote, highly cited trials do not enroll an average of 40.1% of identified patients with the disorder being studied, primarily owing to eligibility criteria. So there are all sorts of ways that you can make your research results actually less generalizable, and lots of these are actually in practice what people are doing. Okay. Second, by identifying research with the systematic pursuit of generalizable knowledge, the distinction implies that clinical experience is neither systematic nor generalizable. On this view, real knowledge comes from research and is then implemented in practice, and only knowledge gained in this way counts. This way of understanding the relationship between research and practice would mean, for example, that a clinician who learns over the course of dozens of cases that her patients have fewer side effects and better overall outcomes on measures they care about when given one treatment rather than another, hasn't engaged in any meaningful learning or knowledge production. These activities are dismissed as sources of decision making, and when this sort of experience leads clinicians to deviate from guidelines, they are often left without community accepted grounds for doing so. Further, community activities such as sharing cases in team-based healthcare settings and presenting at ground rounds fail to register as knowledge productive activities on this view. Accepting the research practice distinction helps to promote the idea that the knowledge to be gained in clinical practice isn't really knowledge at all, and there are good reasons to resist this conclusion. So these two assumptions, each a form of what we are very tentatively calling epistemic elitism, lead to problems by exacerbating the lack of fit between pressing clinical questions and the answers provided by research. So in recent articles, two separate groups of scholars have ventured proposals about the structure of hypothetical healthcare systems that deliberately integrate medical research and practice. So in what follows, we very briefly describe and evaluate each system with particular attention to whether they have identified and critically engaged with these epistemic assumptions in some form or other. So the first paper to address the challenges to healthcare systems of this integration was written by Emily Largent, Stephen Joff, and Frank Miller, so a group at the National Institutes of Health in the United States. Largent and colleagues construct a thought experiment to test the viability of an integrated system. The hypothetical Research Integrated Health System, or RIHS, is a healthcare system designed to integrate clinical research and clinical practice. It is not for profit. It's made up of a network of hospitals and community clinics. Both practice and research are thought to benefit from closer interaction in this system because current patients get better, more evidence-based care, and a more efficient system of enrollment for research subjects contributes to better research results, which in turn improves care for future patients. So patient care is, whenever possible, delivered through clinical trials which recruit patients from the clinic into research studies. So overall, and there's lots more to be said about this account, but again, constraints of time. So overall, the hypothetical system that's designed by Largent and colleagues can be characterized as conducting research in a clinical setting. Their system is based on the idea that, quote, research participation can provide good, even optimal treatment for a given patient, depending on the design of the trial and the patient's other treatment options. And they describe the patients who seek care from the system as, quote, having chosen to receive medical care in the context of research. Moreover, their discussion of this RIHS focuses mainly on traditional clinical trial research in the form of RCTs. Of the six examples of studies that they give in the paper, five are RCTs. So the second model is the learning healthcare system. So more recently, a second group of bioethicists have proposed an ethics framework for a system that also blends research and practice. Their account is developed in two papers published in the Hastings Center report. In one of the papers, the authors envision a learning healthcare system in which research and treatment are completely intertwined. They draw on a 2007 proposal by the American Institute of Medicine, which defines such a system as one, quote, in which knowledge generation is so embedded into the core of the practice of medicine that it is a natural outgrowth and product of the healthcare delivery process. End quote. So Faden and colleagues describe their learning healthcare system as primarily conducting studies that are closely tied to clinical practice. Quality improvement and comparative effectiveness research are described as emblematic of the research that their system would conduct, though there would also be some traditional clinical trials. All of these are grouped under the umbrella term of learning activities. They also use the IOM's term knowledge generation, thus avoiding division of activities into discrete categories of research and practice. So by contrast with the approach to integration that I just highlighted, the REIS, which you will recall involved conducting research in a clinical setting, the learning healthcare system that Faden and colleagues are thinking of can be described as primarily conducting research on clinical care. That is, it is the care that is being delivered that drives the research, and the outcomes being examined are those of actual clinical practice. This system fosters two-way or genuine integration between the traditional activities of research and practice, rather than a sort of one-way integration of research into practice. It also takes seriously the possibility that research and practice could and perhaps should be characterized by precisely the same activities. So we've probably tipped our hand about the relative merits of the two models a bit already, but let us return to the first model briefly, the REIS. So although they do not provide an epistemic argument in support of their model, Largent and colleagues claim that an integrated system like theirs has at least two advantages over the current approach. First, it will be a more efficient way to conduct research because it will be easier to recruit research participants into this integrated system. This increased ease of recruitment would presumably translate into more research being conducted. More research leads to more knowledge, so efficacy of recruitment provides a good, albeit indirect, epistemic justification for moving clinical research into a practice setting. A serious problem with this approach is that more research does not simply equal good research or research that is worth doing. To some extent, this point is obvious. Nobody would argue it's not possible to do a lot of bad research, and I made roughly that argument at my last roundtable talk, I think. But we do need to ask what kinds of research we want more of. Largent and colleagues, as noted, want more RCTs, and a very particular kind of them. As our critique of the epistemic elitism that underlies the focus on RCTs shows, there are costs to this decision. So for instance, as noted earlier, explanatory RCTs are rarely generalizable to typical patient care settings. So that's a cost. A second possibility, also suggested by Largent and colleagues, is that an integrated system will implement evidence-based medicine, or EBM. There's flashbacks to my PhD on EBM every time I have to say the word. EBM is one of those slippery terms that means different things to different people. While some hold that it requires only that clinicians answer the question, what is your evidence for that, when making treatment decisions, others, including some of its most vocal and long-standing advocates, believe there is more to evidence-based medicine than this. In particular, the hierarchy of evidence is often cited as a key feature of EBM. Good, almost there. This hierarchically organized approach would likely embrace a strong flow of research into practice, but see less value in amalgamating the insights of practice in a generalizable form, since such methods would be unlikely to rank very highly on most traditional hierarchies. Thus, the claim that an integrated system will implement EBM may simply amount, again, to conducting more RCTs. If EBM is understood in this way, as seems likely, it would miss opportunities to more radically rethink the way research is conducted. So the kind of moderate integration proposed by Largent and colleagues does have the potential to deal with some of the problems raised by the current more segregated system, but we think they're missing some key opportunities along the way. The radically integrated system developed by Faden and colleagues is more promising. So we think that Faden and colleagues get it right when they say, practice cannot be what it is and cannot be of the highest quality that morally it must be, independent of its intimate connection to ongoing systematic learning. In sum, then, the REIS is guilty of drawing on both of the problematic epistemic assumptions identified above, but the learning healthcare system does better on both counts. So finally, researchers, clinicians, and bioethicists alike have been misled by the research practice distinction into believing that research in its ideal form must use methods that compromise patient care, and that practice in its ideal form involves a single-minded focus on care to the exclusion of any commitment to learning and producing knowledge. These characterizations or caricatures leave us with impoverished research and narrow-minded practice. They exacerbate the knowledge translation problem and lead to a situation in which research neglects practice and clinicians must be browbeaten into incorporating research evidence into practice. Recent developments in medicine are forcing scholars to realize what should have been clear with closer attention to the epistemic assumptions underlying the research practice distinction much sooner than this, namely that the sorts of epistemic elitism it promotes are detrimental to both research and practice. Failing to recognize this may lead bioethicists to endorse new integrated systems that are incapable of achieving either better knowledge or better care, much less both. But the good news is that awareness of this problem can help us choose between and further develop integrative models. Thanks.
So just a quick question. And
yeah.
Thanks for the talk. Sort of a historical question, I guess, given your background on EBM.
Yeah.
For your PhD, I'm wondering, so is it that you're saying that sort of what you call epistemic or methodological elitism and sort of denigration of experiential knowledge in clinical practice, the result of this research practice distinction? Because it seems to me like these sorts of views are consistent with the rhetoric of early EBM, but that also early EBM and some of its influences, such as proponents like, not specifically under the label of EBM, but people like Alan Feinstein, for instance, really were seem to be in favor of a sort of integration between practice and research, both within the clinician. So I'm wondering if this is, I guess I'm just interested in what your take is, whether or not this is the result of the distinction, or is it the result of EBM rhetoric, or both, maybe?
We struggled with how to formulate that language as we were writing the paper.
Yeah.
So we have something like accepts and reinforces or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's these assumptions are not sort of ones that advocates of early EBM came up with on their own. These are sort of out there and floating. They got picked up. They got reinforced by certain kinds of moves, like these political moves with the Belmont Report, making that clear distinction. So, we don't want to say, well, this came up, this was proposed by EBM, and then they've dragged it forward or something, because certainly, as you point out, there's elements within evidence-based medicine itself that push against that conception. So it's a sort of accepts and reinforces along the way, is the way we're trying to think about it. Is that?
That helps
clarify. Okay. It'd be nice if it was a clean relationship, but it's not. Yeah.
So you mentioned the hierarchy of evidence.
Sure.
So I'm just wondering, do you think that needs to be revised? Because of course there are a lot of practitioners who staunchly defend the idea that sort of RCTs are better than cohort studies, which are better.
Yeah.
I totally agree with what you said about RCTs. They're sort of dealing with a very very specific, quite atypical patient group a lot of the time, but they're not as generalizable in some circumstances as some of the other studies.
Sure.
Do you think it needs to be? Revised and more kind of pluralistic.
Yeah, so my co-author on this piece, Robin Bloom, has written, she wrote a really nice paper in the 2005 special issue, Perspectives in Biology and Medicine, something to a network account of evidence in medicine, something like that in the title. So absolutely, yeah, we think the hierarchy, it's a ridiculous way to organize evidence. Having said that, I've written more recently on ways in which, even if we are looking within the category of one method, even if we're just looking at RCTs, we can do much better or much worse on that. So the pragmatic versus the explanatory RCTs. Huge difference in terms of what we're going to get at the end of the day. So there's room for doing better within each category, and also room for just getting rid of this idea that in any case you're going to have only one type of trial that gets you the right answer or the best knowledge. So, but Robin's sort of systems-based network account would be some. What's really going on behind the scenes here. Yeah.
Steve. Thank you. So I can see in practice, research and research practice distinction.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But I just wish you said why we want to do away with distinctions, so why we kind of say that, you know, there's such a chance of hospitals.
Yeah.
And some of it is more ethically risky and other
stuff,
so these perspective
kind of ethical checking.
Yeah. What's the stuff which is more ethically risky? Well, it's the stuff which is after generating knowledge primarily. And the stuff which is after looking after patients primarily tends to be less ethical. And so then I'd say something like a research practice distinction.
Sure.
All I'm saying is, it's kind of useful to distinguish the aims of what's happening in different contexts because of the kind of ethical need.
Good. So I think that this way of drawing that distinction was about the aims or goals of the two activities, and I think what we're trying to say is that way of drawing that distinction doesn't work, especially because what we're seeing is not only that those aims and goals are coming together, but that we would like to see them come together. There's good reason to want to see them come together. So the ethical framework that we're going to need is, right now, if you're thinking about doing something that we would call research now, you have to decide whether what you're doing is producing generalizable knowledge. And we think that the relevant questions that need to be asked there in terms of whether you should then go through a prospective ethics review process or not, whether there's some extra stuff we need to be checking up on, that should track things like, is there net risk to this activity? Are you deviating from standard of care? And the interesting thing is that those happen in practice, right? There are instances in practice where we deviate from standard of care, like off-label prescriptions, as an example. So if what we really want to do is protect patients, we should be protecting patients broadly, whether we want to classify it, you know, in this traditional way or not. So another way of saying that is that the argument isn't that we can't talk about these things, but that defining them in terms of the goals is the wrong way to go. So the characteristic activities of these are going to come together.
Well, I have one last question.
You're still talking about it. I was wondering, it seems to me that the two models that you discussed both still focus very much on what you might label as institutionally organized research done by professionals, either scientific or clinical, whereas at the moment you also see developments in kind of crowdsourced types of research where patients simply submit their data into a system hoping to get something for personal value, but also to contribute to larger knowledge base.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think the two models might also be applied to that, or do we need something else for that development?
I think that those would be examples of the practice moving to research side, that patients are now collecting all sorts of data on themselves, and if those are being brought together, and I mean lots of useless data is being collected, but if that's being brought together in some systematic way, like in these practice-based research networks where you're tracking just the way you would normally treat this patient and what outcomes they would have, and then doing so in a systematic way, then you have something that starts to look more like research. I'm not sure. I'll have to think through the case where it's fully outside of any of this sort of institutional context. In the Belmont report, they make the point that there's experimenting, which is one thing, but then there's this kind of medical research, which is another. And I wonder if that might, I don't know, if that's going to come back in here somewhere. There's some kind of experimenting going on, but
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.